he gave me the suggestion for what I call my little post-it note inventory. And what I do is, at his suggestion, in the morning I sit down and take a couple minutes, and he said, just write out the four or five things you're not going to be willing to do today in order to have a better relationship with God. I said, well, Clint, how about all the things I'm willing to do? And he says, oh, those won't cause you any trouble. Aha. Uh-huh. So here's one that I have. They have with me a little post-it note here, and prayer. God, please turn my heart away from self and towards your will. Number one thing on this morning that I was not willing to do was just be average. You know, I'm willing to be the best you've ever seen or the worst you've ever seen, but I don't want to be a team player. I don't want to just be one of the guys. I've got a mind. The next thing is I want to insist on predicting the future. I know if I do this, you're going to do this, and I'll say this, and you'll say that, and everything else, and I know what's going to happen. And don't try and tell me anything else, because I know. I think I can read other people's minds. You know, I can look at you, and I know exactly what you're thinking. Not. You know. I have a hard time believing that the rules all apply to me. And then finally, I insist on living a life of distraction. Now, what that looks like for me is that, you know, I've at various times I get in trouble with various pieces of that. I've fired up my car and run over the mall, and I'll do a bunch of power shopping, and I'll spend some money I don't have. I went through a period where I was way upside down on a bunch of credit card debt from doing that. I got that paid off and taken care of. There was an interesting thing that happened to me on the way to doing that one day, as a matter of fact, that was a spiritual awakening all in itself. My office at that time was just kind of across the street from our city's upscale mall. And so I decided to rent out and do a little quick shopping on my lunch hour. And I jumped in the car, and just as I got to that intersection to cross the street there, the light was sort of changing. It was kind of pink. And I just floored it and shot through the intersection, and this jerk in this green minivan honks at me, and I don't remember if I flipped him off or not. I could have. But anyway, I'm in there, and I'm driving around trying to find a place to park, and I look in my rearview mirror, and I got a green minivan on my bumper. And so I eventually find a place to park. And I know, remember, I can read minds and predict the future. So I know what's going to happen here. I'm out of my car in a flash. That guy is not going to catch me sitting down in my seat. So I'm out of the car, and I'm ready for trouble. And he comes around the end of that minivan, and I'm winding up. He's not gonna get the jump on me. And then he says, "Mister, would you mind stepping over here and explaining to my daughter why you're getting that parking place 60 seconds sooner than you would have otherwise was worth risking her life?" Whew. Just all the air went out. I get to see myself for who I really am. You know, if you ask me, am I willing to risk a kid's life in order to get a parking place? Of course I'm not. But see, I'm blind, and I'm wrapped up in self-centeredness. It's all about me getting to the mall and everything else. And so I'm spiritually blind, and I don't get it. And so much of this stuff, it's not about me finding answers in life. It's about me working my way to where I get the right question in life. If I can, you can give me the right question, I'll come up with the answers. Are you going to risk a kid's life in order to get a parking place? Of course not. Distraction, you know, I can be busy at various times. We talked about it. I can be busy chasing somebody else's wife, so I can. There's a lot of tension and excitement in that. That's distraction. The most frequent one today is I've got a mind that tells me it's okay to drive 80 miles an hour in the 55 zone around our beltway. And what that means is that I can spend my time looking in the rearview mirror to see where the unmarked car is coming out from under the underpass or not. And, you know, I missed the whole trip. I don't know where I am. That reminds me of an experience I had with my first sponsor. Neil and I were riding around. I don't know why he got in that death trap of a car with me, but Neil was in my car and we were going out to lunch, and we were on the freeway, and I got cut off by this jerk driving a blue Ford Escort, one of these little crap cars, and just cut me off. And it may be old and rusted, but I got myself a 280Z, by God, and so I'm just dogging this guy. And, I mean, I can't see anything else. I'm on his bumper, and by God, he's going to pay. And eventually, I return to sanity here, and I back off the gas and slow down and everything else. And I realized that I'd driven two X's past where we were supposed to get off. And Neil looked at me with that big Santa Claus grin of his. And he says, "Well, Mike, I don't know why you've got so much trouble with the third step. I just watched you turn your will and your life over to a guy driving a blue Corvette Ford Escort." I get all this stuff happening to me, and I'm just clueless. I thought I was the guy with the power there. So let's give the smokers a break here and come back 10 or 15 minutes and we'll talk about some fear. This looks like the bunch we're going to have here, so why don't we get started here? I noticed the group conscience is evolving here. It's evolved from 10 minutes to about 20 minutes here. It seems to be directly proportional to the amount of sunshine outside here. It's funny how this. Sometimes we just get that little rapier-like thrust that exposes the truth. I remember whining to Don one time, and said, "Don, I don't think God's going to work for me." And he looked at me with a little funny expression, and he said, "Well, Mike, why should he?" See? And right there, all of a sudden, I had a flash and a light, you know, what in the world was wrong? See, I had it figured out that God was supposed to work for me. He says, "That's probably not the relationship that's going to happen here. I'm probably not the employer, and God's probably not the employee." So, talking about fear, it's sometimes, you know, I write more and more fear inventory today and less resentment inventory, because I quickly realize that I don't resent anybody I'm not afraid of. I just don't. Resentment inventory, I try and pick the fears out of there, and then we take it into fear inventory. Or sometimes it's a fear that just directly crops up. This little piece here, I realized it was before I was the first one of these that I was ever asked to do out of town was in Santa Barbara. And I realized as the time approached for that, that I was really getting frightened and couldn't figure out what all that was about. And it occurred to me, I finally got down, well, I'm afraid to get on the airplane and fly out there. And so, again, post-it note saved the day. It did in the big book. But why? I asked myself, well, why am I afraid of flying? Well, I'll be out of control. I'm going to have to wait in that aluminum tube in terror till I hit the ground and die. And why do I have this fear? I found it a childish old idea. I found the old idea that somehow my fear was going to protect me. Kids believe that, you know, and that meant when the monster was under the bed, my fear protected me and kept me in the center of the bed. But I'm adult now. I have it because I'm not trusting God, obviously. I believe that I deserve to be punished for my wrongs, and I've got a God that's going to punish me in that way, and that I deserve to die a horrible, painful death. You know? So I got to look at that piece of fear, and then the next set of questions was, you know, well, have I always been afraid of flying? And the answer is, heck no. I used to love to fly, and then I asked myself, well, when did I become afraid of flying? And all of a sudden, I knew exactly. I can tell you that it was before I got on United Airlines contract flight U2B4. I still remember the numbers. Coming home from Vietnam. Not going, but coming home. And during that tour there, I'd been on 5 different choppers that had gone down for various reasons. A couple because they'd been hit by fire, but the rest were for various maintenance problems. And I'd happily got on the next chopper every time and just went on. But when I'm on this great, I'm getting on this, in fact, if that DC-8's parked in the desert someplace, it's still got my palm prints on the armrest there. I'm terrified. I've been through all this, but I'm terrified to get on this civilian airliner. And I could, why in the world would that be? And then it remembered, see, I'd always kind of barely related to Bill's story. And all of a sudden, I came to my mind, Bill's story. Bill talks about going to Winchester Cathedral before he went over to France in World War II and talked about needing and wanting God, and God came to him. And, you know, in my own crude way, when I went to Vietnam, I know I'm an infantry grunt, and I'm going to Vietnam, and no matter how good I think I am at my skills here, my survival is completely out of my hands. You got to practice some common sense here and so forth, but it's really not in my hands whether I make it out of this deal or not. And so, in my own crude way, when I went there and entered that combat period, I turned my will and my life over to the care of God, whether I understood it that way or not. And what happened was when I survived all that combat and I'm ready to go home, in the back of my mind, the little man said, well, thank you very much, God. I'll take it from here. And right at that moment I began to manage my life, I had fear. And so, you know, the inventory taught me something. Now, one of the marvelous things is that I've discovered is there's no better recycler in the world than God. God will take the trash that I produce trying to live my life my way, with good motives even, and he'll recycle it into something useful for somebody else if I'll just let him do that. And one of the things I found out from this little piece of inventory, I was at a gathering sort of like this once, and somehow, out of order, almost near the beginning on Friday night, I happened to mention this. And I looked over, and the guy that was doing the taping had tears running down his cheeks. And, you know, it's all about me, so I'm going, am I that bad that the taper's crying? I mean, that's... Because this didn't seem like sad stuff. Got through the session and went on the break, and coming back from the break, the guy grabbed me coming back, and he said, Mike, because you would have no way to know this, but I've got a son that's dying in a town far away from here, and I haven't gone to see him because I'm afraid to fly. And I just called my wife on the break and told her to buy us some tickets. We're going to see our boy. Yeah. See? So, if I clean up my little mess, if I submit to myself to this process, that's the kind of world I get to live in. I've always got the choice at any given time. Am I going to live in my world, or am I going to live in God's world? My world, God's world. If I live in my world, I get the consequences of living there. And if I live in God's world, I get the consequences of living there. What's my choice to be? And that's why it's so important for me to pay attention to my experience. Because I don't know who or what or how anything's going to touch anybody else. But I do know it's our way of living has its advantages for all. And I thought in the beginning, because of my ego, that that meant that everybody out there ought to live the way I live. And then we'd all be better off. And I got taken back into it and said, no, Mike, when you live this way of life, we're all better off. And so when I live this way, I get to make my contribution. More practical matter here, this little piece of fear inventory, I entitled Office Drama. Dear Father, please take away my fear and direct my attention to your solution. My first fear, Dave, my partner, is going to demand a change in our office sharing arrangement. Why do I have this fear? Well, I've let my business relationship with Dave drift along. I haven't been willing to force a definition of the relationship because I fear more responsibility, either in terms of production targets or cash contribution. The vagueness seemed to suit my purpose. The better way, trust God and humbly seek his help. I need to honestly look at Dave's side of things and remember that he has fears too. I need to be willing to be specific as to duties and responsibilities. Fear under that, I'm going to be harmed by an acrimonious breakup. I've seen some of Dave's behavior toward previous partners. He's done petty things like not forwarding the mail or forwarding phone calls. I have to trust God and humbly seek his help. I must strive to treat Dave fairly, treat him the way I want to be treated. I'm afraid of possible financial disputes arising out of years of unreconciled expenses. My willingness for an accounting varied with whether I thought I was ahead or behind. Imagine that. Again, the vagueness seemed to suit my purpose. I have to trust God and participate in an honest and fair accounting with Dave. My income's going to be harmed. Oh, now we're getting closer to home here. It appears that no matter what the resolution may be, that my expenses will increase. I'll have to pay Dave, buy equipment of my own, or partner with somebody else, whatever the cost that entails. Again, trust God. My income doesn't need to be harmed in the long run, provided I become more productive. I'm going to be forced to change the way I do business. You see me drilling down here? The fear beneath the fear. While I serve my clients well, I do it on my terms and in my time. I spend virtually all my time on the care and feeding of current clients and very little on prospecting for new ones. Again, I must be willing to embrace change in order to outgrow fear. And then where we go, the fear behind that one. I don't know how to change the way I do business. You know, I've never been in a business that required me to be successful at prospecting. I've never had any kind of mentor in this area. Dave is as lost as I am and can't teach me anything here. Again, I must acknowledge my shortcomings and be willing to ask for help and accept it. I need a business sponsor. You know, now we get down, here's what the real fear is. I'm going to fail and be humiliated. I've got this fear because I'm not trusting God. I'm trying to manage a relationship with another alcoholic. Both of us suffer from the disease of extreme self-centeredness, and trying to manage this is insane. I must have God's help. And the answer is trust God and humbly seek His help. God loves me and wants my happiness even more than I do myself. He doesn't cause me to fail. He allows me to fail so that I can learn, not as a punishment. I need to focus on God's agenda and not my own. That got set aside. Those problems got resolved. And here's one I'd rather not read you, but I will anyway. This is called Palm Springs Trauma. And the background on this was, a number of years ago, I got asked to be a banquet speaker at this shindig for 2,000 people in Palm Springs. And I was actually filling in for the real banquet speaker, who would have been Don, but he was ill at the time. And anyway, as the time for this conference approached, I went to one of our local speaker meetings, and a guy I've known for years and really like in the program spoke that night. And I came out of there just muttering to myself, gosh, this guy did a horrible job. Has he lost his mind? Blah, 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 blah. You know, just all about him and this rotten job he did. And I get about three blocks from the church, and I'm going, wait a minute. You know, this isn't about him. This is about me. I'm scared. And that's where I'm kicking up all this dust. So I got home, and I sat down and wrote about my fears here. My first fear is that I'm going to give a boring talk in Palm Springs. Well, why do I have this fear? Well, I'm full of pride, ego, and self-centeredness. I want to impress people rather than to truly be of help and service. I want to show them how good I am rather than how great God and AA are. The better way here, I trust God. I must turn to God and give the talk He wants me to give. Well, the next fear under that was, I'll go blank and forget everything I know. Well, I've got this fear because I'm managing my life and I'm not trusting God. The answer, trust God, of course, and let Him clear my mind of self-serving thinking so I can speak the truth. And I know I'm doing that before I do something like that or something like this when I say that prayer sincerely. God, just reformat the hard drive. Wipe me clean and put Your message there. Not my agenda. The next fear is I'm going to be an embarrassment to the people who recommended me. Well, I got this because I not only want to manage my life, I want to manage the feelings of others. And I'm not doing this for their benefit. I'm doing it for my benefit, my comfort. Trust God. I remember that I'm doing this to be a service. Well, here we go. Next, I don't really belong with this in crowd, and I'm not who and what they think I am. I've got this because I'm busy reading minds again. Once again, I'm more concerned with being what I fancy others think I should be than what God wants me to be. I'm trying to fit myself into Your picture frame instead of God's vision for me. The answer here is to trust God. The truth is that I've always received an abundance of love. Per the St. Francis prayer, I must seek to love rather than to be loved. And then you think, after all of that, I just couldn't believe when this popped out here. The next fear is, I'm never going to be asked to do this again. Oh boy. Well, I said it wasn't pretty. I got this fear because I want to play God, and I want to decide how I'm going to serve God. I'd be willing to take the place, here's a nasty secret, I'd be willing to take the place of somebody who could better carry the message just to serve my own selfish ends and feed my ego. Trust God, and then it came to me, perhaps I can serve God even as a fool. In any case, it is for God to determine how I will serve him. I only get to decide if I will be of service, not how I will be of service. And then finally, this little gem. People will praise me out of kindness and pity. Doesn't it make you sad? I got this fear because I'm acting from self-interest rather than out of a sincere desire to serve God and others. Who in the hell am I to judge the kindness of others and reject it? I mean, let's get a grip. Just who in the heck do I think I am? Wow. I will always suffer when I turn to sources other than God for my sense of worth and well-being. And you know, one of the great stuff about this is I turn the page over and I go through that little exercise I told you about last night. You know, I get to, okay, some guy I sponsored read this inventory to me. Now, what does this guy that read this inventory, what's his relationship with God like? What does he believe, apparently? And I get to look at this. God's waiting to get me. God doesn't care about my happiness, and God would like to make a fool out of me. Now, I get to ask myself, because that's what the guy that wrote this inventory believes, right? I get to ask myself, is that true? See, it's the question that's important. Is that what I really believe? Is that the God that I want to have in my life? You know, they told me a long time ago, and I didn't understand it when they told me, but, you know, Mike, if you want a better life, you better get a better God. Because the fact is, if God is the way you think he is, and people are the way that you're sure they are, you're screwed. There's no hope for you. So you've got a choice. You can either try to swim with your both arms wrapped around that anchor, or you can let go and get a different God. And, you know, at this time it was what I truly believed was God doesn't think comparatively. I'm a child of God and he loves me absolutely and unconditionally. God won't make a fool of me, but I can make a fool of myself by trying to be what I'm not. God wants my happiness, not pleasure, even more than I do. And so that's the deal. When I start out with an inventory about a little rotten fear about a speaker that I thought was antagonizing me, and what I get, the gold out of this, is I get to have my relationship with God straightened out and put on a footing. This is how God and I spend time with each other and get to know each other. You want to know how to develop a relationship with God? Well, you know, the same way that if I wanted to develop a relationship with either you or Bob and I coming up here, we talked about real stuff. We didn't talk about how much money we made on the way up here and this great deal or that great deal or what kind of cars we were going to buy. We were talking to each other from the heart. And Bob and I have got the beginnings of a relationship. And hopefully we'll, over time, as time passes, we'll talk to each other more and we'll have a deeper relationship. Well, if I want to have a relationship with God, duh, you know. This is how I have that relationship. You know, can you imagine trying to have a relationship, maybe you have with somebody, who came into your office and said, I want you to do this, this, and this, and this. I want you to make it rain toads on them. I want you to kill them and, by the way, make her go away. And then they just turned around and walked out of your office and so forth. Well, that's what a lot of my praying looked like. There's no relationship in that. Yeah, prayer is part of it. But in order to be in a dialogue with God, it comprises speaking and listening, you know. There's real intimacy in that. Into me see. I am going to let you see into me. God, I'm going to sit here and with my pen, I'm going to tell you the secrets of my heart. What I'm afraid of, when I'm afraid of any other people knowing, and I'm going to let you see that. And on that basis, we're starting to have a relationship, and it gets deeper. And just like the friend, over time we're going to trust each other more. God didn't need to learn to trust me, but I need to learn to trust Him. But this is so much more than just writing about stuff. And that's why this inventory is not a hassle. It's a very loving tool if we'll use it that way. It's not just about confession of stuff. It's about an opportunity for us to develop a relationship. I started out last night reading that inventory about my sexual conduct with my fiance. And I made mention that the questions that were given in there are very effective questions for other kinds of relationships. And so some years ago, my mother went into a care center for Alzheimer's disease in 1997, November. And she went into a center that was near my old hometown simply because the conditions and the staffs and everything else were better with a bunch of people, Iowa farm girls and stuff, that staffed the nursing home that was close there than what we could find in the big cities. Matter of fact, the people that owned this facility had some of their own relatives in residence there. So she got very special care there. And I have two brothers that still live close to her. And my sister lives in St. Louis. And I live where I live, you can't really fly from here to there, because and it's about a 6-hour drive. So I noticed that things weren't right in my heart with my mother here, so I needed to write here. And I used the questions from that sexual conduct inventory. Father, please set aside my prejudice so I can see the truth. This is mother. I have selfishly avoided my mother as her Alzheimer's has progressed. I've called infrequently and done minimal visiting. I've dishonestly assumed that her condition prevents her from realizing what my behavior is, that I can just show up from time to time and she won't know the difference. I've inconsiderately let my brothers and sister do most of the heavy lifting. I've only done what they've specifically asked me to do and given support to them. I haven't gone the extra mile. I've emotionally abandoned Mom for my own comfort and to avoid the feelings of powerlessness, grief, and fear her condition causes in me. I mentally deal with her as she used to be, not as she is. When I allow myself to reflect on this, it's as if I've buried her alive. I need to honestly face my emotions about her conditions. I must stop playing God. She's alive, and I must maintain a relationship with her as if she's fully cognizant, because she may be from time to time, and I don't know which times those will be. And so, thanks to this, instead of standing at her grave 2 weeks ago with a heart full of regret, I got to change my actions. As a matter of fact, the last time I saw her, I didn't know for sure at the time, but I was sitting face to face with her, and she kind of smiled, and I looked at her, and she's looking at me and studying my face, because I went from being her son Mike to that nice young man who visits from Indianapolis to she didn't really know, at least not all of the time. And she was studying my face, and I did this deal toward my eyes, like from the Fockers here. I says, "You see these, Mom?" I says, "Do you know where I got these?" And they're her blue eyes, and she all of a sudden broke into a big smile. And I spent the rest of the time with her, and I was driving back, and I got a call on my mobile, and it was my sister, and she said, "After you left, Mom said your name twice." See, I used to say my mom suffered from Alzheimer's, and that wasn't the truth. I suffered from it. The truth was, my mother got the best care I could imagine in that place. She was their favorite resident because she was always their happiest resident. And I all of a sudden realized that living in a condition that she deeply feared to be in, that she was happy because she was living 100% of her time in the present. She wasn't pissed off about anything that happened in the past, and she wasn't even worried what she was going to have for dinner. She was right here, right now. She's where all the gurus tell us to want to be. Be here now. Mom was spiritually perfect, and she was here now. And that the problem was mine, not hers. And so I got to see the truth, and I got changed. Let's take a break, and lunch is going to be in a couple of minutes. And why don't we, if we can get back here, it's as close to one as we can get the next session in and then set you all free for the springs or the golf course or... All those that were only casually affected are off doing other pursuits now. But we'll try and get this wrapped up and set you free for the rest of the afternoon here. Okay. Boy, you just sleep quietly, Tom, there. I had some questions, and I realized that I omitted telling you about what back home we call the bridge. And the bridge for us is simply those series of actions that we take after we've written the third column and we're trying to make our way to the fourth column from how I'm affected over to my mistake here. And so we'll sketch that in here. Down toward the bottom of page 66, it gives me the outline for this. It says, I'm going to turn back to the list, for it holds the key to my future. Okay, you got my attention now. I'm prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. I begin to see that the world and its people really dominated me. In that state, the wrongdoing of others, fancied or real, had the power to actually kill. How can I escape? I saw that these resentments must be mastered, but how? I can't wish them away any more than alcohol. I don't know if any of you like me tried to wish resentments away. I used to go, oh, I forgive you. It's no big deal. I forgive you. And it was a big deal. And I didn't forgive you. And finally, it was an Al-Anon that set me free on this. She said, you know, Mike, if I can't tell you no, saying yes to you is meaningless. And I found out until I got down and I was willing to touch and feel and write about and experience the anger I had towards you, my forgiveness was bullshit. You know, it was just some kind of a deal I did to make myself feel temporarily better, and it wasn't real forgiveness because I was right back in the same place sooner or later. I don't get to spew that on you, but I need to get it on paper and understand just how angry with you I am. And then I get to see how frightened I am, which is the real bottom line here. And what I come to see here in that third column, what's it affected? My finances, my sex life, my security, all this kind of stuff. What I see all of a sudden up to then, I mean, I'm resenting you, and I've got the notion in my mind that you're paying a bill and you're suffering because I resent you. And I start to get carried into the truth. And the truth is the loss of security, the financial insecurity, all this stuff here, my sex life degraded, all this kind of stuff. That's the price I'm paying to have this. You know, I now once I get it that this is costing me and this is a bill I'm going to have to pay, I am now willing to have a look at this from a different angle. And I can't do this on my own, so They give me a series of prayers here where my heart gets turned in literally in a different direction. And I start to see once again that my troubles truly are of my own making here. Tells me this is my course. I realize that the people who had wronged me were perhaps spiritually sick. Am I willing to concede that they might be spiritually sick? Though I don't like their symptoms and the way they disturb me, that's what they did to me, they, like myself, are sick too. Okay, so now we're just two patients sharing a room. It's changed. And it tells me, I ask God to show me, because I can't do it myself, help me show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience that I cheerfully grant a sick friend. When a person offends me, I say to myself, not to them, to myself, this is a sick man. How can I be helpful to him? God, save me from being angry. Thy will done, be done. All little prayers. And it tells me what to do. It says, I avoid retaliation or argument. I wouldn't treat a sick person that way. I go to see a friend in the hospital and he's dying from lung cancer. Do I rage at him what a dumbass he was for smoking for 30 years? Of course not. Of course not. So why am I treating the spiritually sick person that way? Only because I'm too blind to their disease. My disease blinds me to their spiritual sickness. So I'm asking God to lift the veil so I can see what's really going on here. I can't be helpful to all people, you know. We all know that. But at least, here's the minimum bottom line, but at least God will show me how to take a kindly and tolerant view of each and every one. Each and every one. And they pointed out to me, tolerance and kindness are two different things. I can tolerate you without being kind to you. And if we're sick, we desperately need kindness. So now I'm ready. This is to turn back the list. Turning back the list, putting out of my mind, not looking for my part, but putting out of my mind the wrongs others done, I resolutely look for my own mistake. Where had I been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? Though a situation had been not entirely my fault, I tried to disregard the other person entirely. That's like completely. So, when we have that fifth step experience, my literal experience is the more I'm able to share some material, the freer I get. Most of that stuff I read here earlier on was stuff that was, you know, whispered. The first time it was read, it was something I whispered in somebody's ears, and I was half hoping they didn't hear it all, you know. And I get set free so I can sit in front of a room full of people and share that. Because the promise of that work was fulfilled for me. I got to face it and be rid of it. That's not who I am anymore. That's a report about who I used to be. Now I can become that person again. But today I'm not. And so I can hold my head high and share that with you. Because that's, with God's help, I don't have to repeat that behavior. And we get a marvelous set of promises with this fifth step here. It says, once we've taken this step, withholding nothing, by the way, we are delighted. I can look the world in the eye. I don't know, I looked at my shoe tops for a long time. One of the toughest things I ever had to do was be sober around here and look other people in the eye. And people don't like financial planners who won't look them in the eye. I don't know why. Something about their money. I can be alone at perfect peace and ease. I always had to have something going on. You know, I could never just be alone and let it be quiet. My fears fall from me. I begin to feel the nearness of my Creator. I may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now I'm beginning to have a spiritual experience. And the experience is that relationship is getting built. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. We feel that we're on the broad highway walking hand in hand with the Spirit of the universe. That's a sweet set of promises. And sometimes with guys I work with, they call me back in 2 hours and they're panicked. I don't feel that way yet, Well, let's just wait and see what happens over the next week. Let's give this a chance. And inevitably, we can sit down and find where these things are appearing with them, or not, because they're talking about, then we go back into, well, did we withhold something? And that's, I didn't think it mattered. Yeah, I see I'm not alone here. So they give me a very simple set of instructions that my head wanted to complicate. Here it says, but just tells me to go back home and find a place where I can be quiet for an hour. Now I got to tell you, when I first did this, I took an alcoholic hour. That was 35 to 45 minutes. That was the alcoholic hour here. And I carefully review what I've done. And I didn't know how to do that in the beginning. But I finally occurred to me that I could ask somebody to show me how to do that. How do I do a careful review of what I've done? And I thank God from the bottom of my heart that I know Him better. And that's a marvelous deal, see, because as I who I am is disclosed to me, I know God better. As I know myself better, I know God better. And that's no accident here. If I want to know God better, I walk in here and I get to know Him better. Taking this book down from the shelf, I turn to the page which contains the 12 steps. Carefully reading the first 5 proposals, I ask myself if I've omitted anything. Did I shortcut on this deal? Did I just kind of try and wiggle through? Because I'm building an arch through which I'll walk a free man at last. It's kind of the image I use is to look, what we're doing is we're packing a parachute here. And guess who's going to get to jump it? So I want to give this the same attention I'm going to give packing a parachute that I'm going to have to go out of an airplane with. Maybe have a different image for you based on your experience. Carefully reading the first 5 proposals, I look and see if I've omitted anything from building an arch through which I shall walk a free man. Is my work solid so far? Are the stones properly in place? Have I skimped on the cement put into the foundation? Have we tried to make mortar without sand? I'm basically looking at, did I do a half-assed job? Did I just slap some paint on it like one of those school projects and hope to just kind of slide through with it? After spend my hour in reflection here, one of the things I really tell the guys I work with is don't screw yourself. Don't cheat yourself. Go spend an hour. You've done good work up till now. You've really put some effort into this. This may not look like much to you, but I'm telling you it is. It's like making a cake and putting it in the oven, decide you're going to pull it out 15 minutes early. You aren't going to get the cake you would if you left it in there an hour. Don't shaft yourself. If I can answer these questions to my satisfaction, I then look at step 6. It says, we've emphasized willingness as being indispensable. Now, indispensable is something you can't do without, right? And indispensable is also something that can't be dispensed. It can't be given away. Nobody else can give me willingness. You can't dispense it to me. So 2 ways to consider that. It's vital here. Am I now willing to let God remove from me all the things which I have admitted are objectionable? That's what that inventory was about. Here's the stuff that's objectionable to me. Can he now take them all, every one? And if I still cling to something and won't let go, I ask God help me be willing. And they told me, Mike, what you're going to do is you're going to pray for willingness, not wait for willingness. One of my old scams from my junior guru days was that if you ask me where I was in the steps, somebody be sharp and says, well, Mike, where are you in this? Oh, I'm on step six. I'm becoming entirely ready, you know. And I was the truth was I was out there circling the drain, you know. I liked that step six because it sounded like I was just a little more than halfway. So I'd made some effort and some good progress, but it sounded legitimate to be waiting to be. It sounded kind of spiritual, in a matter of fact, you know, that I'm just kind of waiting for God to make me entirely ready, you know, to go on here. But they said we don't sit on any of this stuff. We're going to pray for the willingness, not wait for the willingness. We're going to pray, say the prayer, and move on. Is what we're going to do. And you know, Don pointed out to me that he says, you know, if you look at this seven-step prayer, he says it's really just the third-step prayer with some teeth in it. Now the language becomes a little more binding for the word mechanics here. And I'm talking about real surrender here. My Creator, I'm now willing that you should have all of me, the good and the bad. I'm giving up my judgment. This is good, this is bad, you can have this, you can't have this. That's all done with. Here you are, the good and the bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my useless to you and to my fellows. Not the ones that are troubling me, not the ones that are making me feel bad, not the ones that will improve my image. No, I'm giving all that up. You take what you want. Grant me strength to go out here from here to do your bidding. And here we have the amen. Now, Father Larry, that's in our home group, I think has one of the best images that I've ever come across for this seventh step. And the way Larry puts it, he says, you know, if God were to come by and see me, and I had one of these Whitman samplers of chocolates, and God came to the door and came in, and I was going to offer God a piece of candy, would I hold out the box and let him pick the one he wants, or would I hold the box behind my back and just pick one out and hand it to him? You know, so here I am. It's all yours. You pick right here. What I'm doing here is I'm giving spiritual consent. The surrender, the same. When I was on that gurney at 5 o'clock in the morning, and they came by with the consent form and said, you know, Mr. Lorenz, here's all that we're going to do this surgery on you, and we may do it this way, and we may do it that way, and we may even decide to do it some other way, so on and so forth, and here are a whole list of possible bad side effects and everything else. Do you consent to this surgery? I get to either consent or not consent. I don't get to do my own surgery. You know, I didn't get to fix myself. I give spiritual consent. Okay, thy will be done. You can perform the surgery, and you'll do it the way you do it. You know, and that's the deal here. Real surrender and real peace. Go ahead.
My name is Mark. I'm an alcoholic. Mark. The biggest deal, you just explained it one more time. And then I fought that six and seven step for years. And I come to find out when I said we are entirely ready, what makes it? What makes me entirely ready to give up these character defects? I come to find out, in a moment of clarity, I took a few to do this. The deal that what makes me entirely ready is that I've done the first five steps. we go, we can make that spiritual link between 6 and 7.
Yeah.
But when that made that, when I finally got that doctor's contact, I said, oh, because I can't get away with shit, I need to get away with it.
Yeah.
And I have to give up my concern. I'm tired of it. That makes sense to me.
Yeah, very good. Well, you know, isn't it amazing what I will do even at this point to try on hold on to some illusion of control? You know, I'm sitting here, I'm laying on the gurney, and I've got a head that's still trying to negotiate. You know, I mean, hello. I mean, don't you think God's got to be awfully amused at this? Watch. I mean, watching the little man on the gurney try and negotiate. I mean, you know, come on. And I do that and it's still working for me? Oh, yeah? Well, what's it still working for me? Maybe it's still working for me because I still got a credit line so I can dig my hole a little deeper. Yeah, that's still working for me, you know? I can go see her a few more times, you know, and create some bigger harm and more amends. You know, that's what my mind tells me is still working for me. That's either illusion or delusion on my part. The fact is that, you know, I wrote this. I can see it in my own handwriting. My wife, bless her heart, used to have just the question for me that I hated. Because I'd have this well-reasoned position or argument, and she'd just look at me and she says, well, dear, how's that working for you? And I go, well, you didn't understand. Let me explain again. You know, and it just come back. Well, okay, that sounds good. How's it working for you? And I get to see that it ain't working for me. I thought it was, but it wasn't. And it's just not working for it. So now I'm ready to release it. I've got some apprehension because I'm human about what the future. Who am I going to be without these defects? I get so identified and worried, by the way, that all of a sudden God is going to turn me as pure as the driven snow. And who would I be if I was, you know, pure as the driven snow, and I wouldn't recognize myself, and I wouldn't even be somebody I'd care to spend time with? But that, I've never seen that happen. You know, what it does do is it takes me to a point where the mistakes I've been made, the harm I have done, and everything else start to get turned into instruments that can help and heal others, if I'm willing to do that. So I'm going to work in God's world instead of on the Mikey plan. This is a bad place because I don't know where I got it. I'm sure I heard it in a meeting and it sounded great sometime, but the first time I did this, I'd made the mistake of burning my inventory. And they explained to me I was going to go make this eight-step list. I made it when I wrote inventory. And, you did what with it? Well, I burned it, you know. And... you know, today I don't burn an inventory anymore because it can. I got a whole stack of tablets in the back of my closet, and when I sit down with a man over at my place and we start fist stepping, and he hits something, I can, oh, well, let's see, that sounds like it's here on this tablet, you know, and we can go back, and see. Oh, okay. One of the things that the isolation of this stuff produces for me is I'm just sure that I'm the only one that's ever sinned this way, or whatever you want to call it. I'm the only one that has coveted his neighbor's dog or something like that. I'm the only one who's ever looked at a farm animal this way. I mean, you know, I don't. Whatever it is, and I one more time. See that. You know, I know I'm like you in 90% of it on the surface is, you know, we're just alike and everything else, but I got that little piece that I'm trying to hold on to that makes me different. And Clint helped me a great deal there. He says, you know, you're going to have to learn how to make that peace with that part of you that's never going to get it. There's going to always be some piece of you that just doesn't get it. You may get 99% of it, but if you've got hatred for that piece of yourself, you'll always be unhappy. And you won't be very useful either. So I can the same way, you know, and he showed me. He said, when this guy comes in and reads an inventory to you and there's something in it, whatever it is in there, he said, how do you really feel about him? Doesn't your heart go out to him and everything else? Of course it does. Now, why can't you do that for yourself? You know, just who the hell do you think you are not to make peace with that part of you? You know? And it's, again, it's that ego trying another angle to get a little power. Well, I'm going to get some power because, by God, I'm not going to release myself here. I'm not going to forgive myself here. And you know, the ego just, it gets deflated and it regroups and it attacks from a different direction. You know, and it's always going on. And it's like everything else. Sunshine's the world's best disinfectant here. You know, the more my life is open, the fewer secrets I have, the freer I am. And so I made my list here, and I wouldn't consider approaching this without... This is where my sponsor gets to earn his pay. Because I'm one of those folks from earlier attempts before I'd really done this work, I'd gone out and made a bunch of half-assed amends. And there were people I had to go back and make amends to for the way I made amends to them. And let's be straight about it. I went out and made those amends because I thought I was going to get something from them. In some cases, I just wanted approval. In some cases, I wanted their affection. In some cases, I wanted their money. But I went out there with a real agenda, hidden agenda, you know. And it just didn't work very well. And I created more harm by doing that. So today I'll make that list, and I was told they still do it the same way. I made three lists. The ones that I was willing to make, the ones that I might be willing to make, and the ones, the no-never column. And to my immense relief, my sponsor... help weed those columns. You know, he says, well, I don't think, you know, there's, particularly in the beginning, I had an exaggerated sense of the harm that I'd done in the world. You know, I thought I'd been this terrible whirlwind force, and I had terribly harmed some people, but I didn't need to go out and make amends to every blade of grass that I'd ever been either. In fact, if I did try to do that, I just diminished the value of the process. And so we came down with the list. The sponsor helped me weed the list out. And then we decided which ones needed to be seen in which way. Who should I see in person? Who should I write a honest letter to? And who should I perhaps just leave alone? And I didn't get to... You know, sponsor's judgment and mine varied considerably on that, and based on experience, he was right more than often. He's a lot better track record than I had on that. And as I got ready to do this the first time, I happened to be having a conversation with Don and mentioned, "Well, Don, I'm ready to really go out and start making some amends now." And he says, "Well, what do you expect to get from that?" And I said, "Well, Don, I want to get free. And I want to get forgiven." And he says, "Well, Mike, if you've done the 8-step correctly, you're free right now. You're free. You got free the moment you were in completely willing to go make that amend. You're free. What you're going to do now is some of the people that you harmed aren't free. They're in bondage to the harm you created in their life. Their time is being wasted being angry with you or hurt by you or whatever. So what you're going to do now, you're already free. You're going to go see if they would like to be free too and offer that freedom to them." through this amends process. And I didn't get that. And he says, by the way, if what you want is forgiveness, you're going to have to offer forgiveness. You can't in any piece of your heart withhold forgiveness and expect to receive it yourself. So, any questions up to this point? All right. Well, why don't you take the afternoon off, and we'll see you about 1 hour after dinner this evening then. Enjoy.
Thank you.
It's just blowing my mind here. I really love this group. You've been so kind to me and letting me get to know a great number of you, and I hope I still get to spend more time and with more of you before we're wrapped up here. But I get to see a bunch of groups from time to time, and I'll reinforce probably what you already intuit, that this is an exceptional group. This is not your average group of guys in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I want to honor that. So thank you again. We're going to kind of close the loop here tonight, hopefully, on the turning it over process. I used to have that illusion we talked about that I turned things over when I took that third step. But what I really did was a vital and important step, but it was just really part of a turning it over process. That turning it over process began with me understanding that I was powerless over my ex-wife. And that everything I was trying to do to manage that situation with her, every time I tried to manage it, it just seemed to get worse. And so I got a first step in place with that. And then the next thing I had to decide was there a spiritual help available to me with this problem? I mean, I knew there was spiritual help available to me with my drinking, but was there spiritual help available to me with this divorce, with this breakup of the family here? And then I needed to be willing to ask for the spiritual help. And then I had to pick up my pen and write about what had gone on. And most appropriately, I had to get down to my mistakes in the situation, and where I'd been afraid, and how fear had driven me, And when I did that, I got an image. I got an image of a stretch limo pulling up in front of my house in the morning, and this thing that kind of looked like death warmed over in a tux opening the back door and says, "Hi, I'm Fear. I'm going to drive you around today. You know, step in. You know," and I got to see how literally my fears were just carrying me around through my life. And I got to share that with just the man I trusted most in the world, and then I got opened up to sharing it with other men. And then I sat with that and I got to a place where I said, "God, you know, if you'd take this mess I've made away, I'm willing to surrender putting any conditions on it. Because up to now, it had to have a certain kind of outcome. And now I'd become ready to have God's vision for me rather than my vision for me." And I looked back at what I'd written and I saw who I'd harmed. And I became willing to make amends to them. And so now here finally, as we talk about the ninth step, we close the loop on this process. And it doesn't, I used that particular example with my marriage, but anything literally that I'm, quote, trying to turn over, I don't turn it over by just flicking a little prayer out to the universe. I've got to be willing, God will be certainly be my, I started to say my partner in this, but that's not the way it is. God's willing to carry me through this, but I've got to do some work myself. I always related to Clint's comment, he says, it's like a law firm. It'll start out God and associate.